Hello and welcome to the Sonic Cinema Podcast. My name is Brian Scuttle. Thank you very much for joining me at www.sonic-cinema.com as well as the Sonic Cinema Podcast YouTube channel. You can click subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether it is the YouTube channel or Apple, Spotify, Good Pods, basically whatever podcatcher you listen to. Any support in that respect is appreciated. You can also check me out at patreon.com/sonic cinema. There you will find series like Leaving the Collection and Life Soundtrack, as well as my thoughts on short films that I watch at the current Atlanta Film Festival, as well as just other things that come up through the year. And that is at patreon.com/sonic cinema. So it's funny because of the fact that a few years ago, I did my friend Robert Yannis Jr.'s podcast, Close Watch. And the movie that I wanted to talk to with him was the movie we are talking about now, Alex Proyas's The Crow. And when I was leading up to that episode, and when you listen to that episode, I think one of the things that comes through is I was looking at that as kind of the end-all be-all of my discussion on The Crow, because I've written several pieces that you can find on Sonic Cinema. I talked about the soundtrack on another podcast. I'd done a discussion of the soundtrack on this podcast in regards to a piece of music that I wrote in college called In a Lonely Place that was inspired by The Crow. But as we were coming up to the 30th anniversary, and honestly, because this is such an important film for me in terms of my cinematic development, it just made sense to have a discussion on the film on the Sonic Cinema Podcast with another fan, and that is what we are doing today. Join me for his first time is somebody that I've known from film Twitter for several years. He's always been fun to interact with, even if Twitter's not been very fun in general. Please welcome to the show Chris Salazar. Chris, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, this being your first time on the podcast, I'd like to start by just kind of getting to know you a little bit. What inspired you to fall in love with films the way you did? If there's a place that we can get your thoughts on movies online, where is that? And just kind of get to know you a little bit as far as your journey with movies.
Well, so ever since I was a kid, my father's always been very adamant on taking us to the movies as a family. Very first movie I saw in theaters was actually Star Wars Episode One. Actually 25 years ago. Jeez.
I know.
And it's funny, I actually vividly remember sitting at the very front row at the age of like 4 and a half, just like, I knew then, even at such a young age, that was the worst thing in the house. But at the time, it was 1999, there was no assigned seating.
Yeah.
So you couldn't get the best seats in the house, and there were no recliners. Mm-hmm. So it was the good old crappy squeaky little chairs with literally just having your face implanted on the screen with Darth Maul and the awfulness of Jar Jar Binks. But aside from all of that, God, I remember the horrible Jar Jar Binks lollipop they had. Anyway, Star Wars discussion, my gripes and Phantom Menace aside, I was very much like into going to the movies quite a bit ever since I was a kid, having my own portable DVD player. After my parents split, my mom was cool enough to let me watch Scream, and was reluctantly allowing me to watch horror movies, because at the age of 10, I was like, no, no, it's fine. I'll be fine. I'll just watch them during the daytime. She's like, okay, well, you know, watch it during the day. Don't watch it at night. So, like, every Saturday morning, normal kids, they usually watch cartoons. I mean, I did, too. I had my fair share. X-Men Evolution Army, if you're listening to this. That's a nod. But, normal kids would watch cartoons at the age of 10. I literally was watching Final Destination 2 and Freddy vs. Jason in the living room TV, much to my parents' chagrin. So, what really got me into viewing film the way that I have, though, was when I was 10 years old, I was watching a lot of meta films, especially the Scream franchise, Scary Movie, even though it was a satirical comedy, was still very much like meta in its own right as well. And with that, I got to learn like all the different archetypes of characters, all the different terminologies for what happens in films, like cliches and the third acts and the types of horror movie archetypes, especially such as the Final Girl, the Red Herring, and Scream, and all that. And it really just kind of opened this world that I never knew was there. So my journey ended up becoming increasingly chaotic. I started venturing into different action films, did sci-fi for a bit, didn't care for that, was very narrow for a while in terms of range until the pandemic. Obviously, 2020 being 2020, you had more than enough time to explore your range. And even though I maintained it safe going with like the mainstream blockbusters, a few award season contenders, I felt like watching it, or, you know, just your typical action, standard action movie fare, or bro comedy, I fell back in love with horror during the pandemic. Because I decided there's no movie that will ever be more terrifying than watching the news.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that still remains true today. Yeah. So, I always tell people, always tell me, oh, what's the scariest movie ever seen? I always tell them the news.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped watching because it was that terrifying. On top of that, not only did I rediscover my love for Scream and all these other slasher films, I've always wanted to see The Crow and other 90s, early 2000s gothic films like that, such as Dracula 2000 and Queen of the Damned. Now, my family had a very religious upbringing. While my father, back in the day, saw the Christopher Lee, Hammer, Dracula movies in theaters. I was a kid, so being 6 years old at Blockbuster, because, you know, apparently I haven't dated myself enough. being 6 years old at Blockbuster, asking my father if I could rent Dracula 2000 was a very loaded question, despite the fact that my father watched all the Christopher Lee Dracula movies as a kid. Obviously, I was six, so I was not allowed to watch that. I've always had a fascination with the aesthetic of The Crow, much to my family's chagrin, because, you know, there were a certain sector of people that were very much like, always about living a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So, not gonna put me on blast here, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So, when the pandemic happened, it's like, all right, you know, it's the Wild Wild West. Allow me to explore my options, and that movie kind of came up. I don't know how, actually. It just did. And I was like, sure, let's watch it. So I actually bought it on Apple Digital, which, sorry, physical media supporters, I'm very sorry about that. I didn't know the repercussions of that. Don't kill me. Please don't send me to film jail. No. So I bought it on digital. I watched it and I was like, oh my God, this movie's awesome. This might actually be my favorite movie of all time. And it turned out to actually be, because it had a little everything.
Yeah.
Also, the soundtrack was and still is one of the best movie soundtracks of all time. It's one of my favorites. It's up there with Queen of the Damned, Dracula 2000, and Scorpion King. So, name a few movie soundtracks that I adore. And I even did something ridiculous for a little bit until a friend of mine told me, you're insane. And that person turned out to actually be right. I said to myself, all right, I don't know when this quarantine period is going to be over. So I'm just going to keep watching this movie until quarantine ends. That lasted for about a week. But then I gave myself a break and revisited it. And I'm like, this movie isn't really old for me at all. This movie is actually still amazing.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much my story with Crow and all sorts of different other movies. I had a Letterboxd in 2013, scrubbed most of my 2013 reviews because they were absolutely written by an 18-year-old. And I'm like, I probably shouldn't write about that or shouldn't have said that. Or that opinion is definitely a lot different. But so.
Yeah, there's some.
I also did a lot of
review
writing as well.
Yeah. So. No, I mean, I'm the exact same way. I've got some reviews written from when I was a late teens, early 20s that people will never see on Sonic Cinema just because of the fact that I wouldn't have written that the way I did now. That's not what I would write. That's not how I would write. It's not reflective of who I am. And yeah, I completely understand that as well. I've talked about this on the podcast before. I also know that feeling of like unlocking horror films when you're like 10, you know, and I had similar back and forth with my parents who were not overtly religious, but given that I was an only child, given the fact that I had a very difficult early life, they were very protective of me, and they were very concerned that I might take my obsession with horror movies a little bit too far. I mean, it all came out, you know, I mean, this is during the 1980s too. So it's like you're dealing with Satanic Panic and all of that stuff. And so, you know, you have all of those things that come up. But yeah, I mean, so going specifically to The Crow, I mean, I know I've talked about my past with the movie before. I did not see the movie immediately when it came out in May of 94. I'd heard about it. I read about it. I was interested in it. But, you know, and I think this is still kind of that sort of back and forth with my parents. But, I mean, it was also because of the fact that I very much did not like the idea of getting in trouble. And so I did not necessarily try sneaking into R-rated movies, which, I mean, granted, I was 16 years old, so I probably could have gotten away with it, but at the same time, I just, that's who I was. I was not interested in being that person. So I didn't necessarily, and because my parents weren't interested in seeing her, my mom wasn't interested in seeing it, we didn't go see it. I did get the soundtrack, though, which I absolutely loved, and to your point, it is still one of the best soundtracks ever done. And I listened to that throughout the few months and talked to friends about the movie who had seen it. They really liked it. And finally, in late July, turns out the last day it was at the local discount theater, which is a thing of the past. I don't know if there's any such discount theaters around anymore.
I think I saw like a dollar theater in Florida once.
Yeah.
But
yeah, they're a dying breed to be sure. Which is a shame because of the fact that we don't have the longevity of box office staying in theaters that we did in the 90s. So I went before I had to go to marching band practice one day. I'm like, I'm going to go see it. I was like, I don't know, about a week or so from my 17th birthday. So it's like, I should be fine. But, and sure enough, I got a ticket. It was fine. It was in the discount theater. It was a Thursday afternoon after school. Or, no, school wasn't even in at the time. But, It was for me, it was like a lightning bolt went off. Like the way people talk about the first Star Wars movie or Raiders of the Lost Ark or any movie or Jaws or any movie that triggers their love of movies to just go to another level. That is what The Crow was to me. It was unlike anything I had ever seen up till that point. And as it turns out, that was the last day it was at the second run theater. So next time I could watch it was when it came out in VHS to age myself, as if I haven't already done so. So I rented it. The first weekend it became available in VHS. I basically watched it every freaking day, and I waited patiently for a previously viewed copy to become available because that's how you did it. Not every movie was to sell right away. And as soon as that happened, I bought that, and then I bought the widescreen version because you had pan and scan and widescreen because nobody understood that they weren't necessarily seeing part of the movie during pan and scan. And my history of The Crow is just it's still one of my favorite movies of all time. It's basically 1A with Buster Keaton, Sherlock Jr. 1A, 1B, those two are for very different reasons, obviously. But yeah, this is a movie that, you know, and I'd read about it, so I knew about the accent with Brandon Lee. And this is a movie, when I compare it to Star Wars, it goes to the hype I felt towards the movie as well from a merchandising standpoint. I got myself an Eric Draven statue. I got the trading cards that came out. I got the James O'Barr graphic novel. I was obsessed with the idea of this first sequel coming out. And I got that novelization, got the soundtrack, got all of this. And so it really was that moment for me where the way I looked at films, the way I looked at hype for films and had hype for films changed completely. What was it about The Crow that first time you saw it? And, you know, look, you are in a safe space here. I am a physical media I'm somebody who is very much pro physical media, but at the same time, I have several movies that I've purchased that are streaming only. And it's just because of the fact that, you know, I want to watch those movies away from my house. So I don't feel the need to necessarily have them on physical media. But the ones that I care, truly do care about, I have on physical media. So what was it about The Crow that resonated with you so strongly that first time you watched it?
Just the fact that it was, well, first off, the music, for sure.
Yes.
And the aesthetic, definitely the aesthetic. And also, like, the whole Brendan Lee story, I remember hearing about that, and then for a while, I'm like, do I even want to see this? But then again, this also, this conversation occurred around the same time that The Dark Knight came out.
Yeah.
Obviously, I went to go see that, even though that was a different situation. And right. I was like, okay, I could stand watching The Dark Knight after Heath Ledger's unfortunate passing. Surely I could watch this. And I said to myself foolishly, I'm like, there's no way this is ever going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I was wrong. We were all wrong because of, well, the Alec Baldwin incident.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also just loved the gothic elements of it as well. I've always been into gothic stuff. I mean, I did watch Underworld when I was 8. My first crush, movie crush, was Celine, one of. And I was very much into all of that. And then I'm not sure what happened. I was like, I just lost sight of all of that. And I was like, okay. You know, then when 2020 happened, it was almost like I found myself again.
Yeah.
In the chaos. So with all of that, I said to myself, I'm like, it's all right. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as far as like the whole physical, digital streaming, I'm going to be honest, like, I'm learning. I learned quite a bit now. Because, you know.
Yeah.
Before, I'm like, oh, it's just the way things are. It is what it is. It doesn't matter. I'm like, no, it actually does matter. Especially with Warner Brothers and, you know, Zaslav's onslaught.
Yeah.
it really does matter.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you know, it's like the, excuse me, you know, it's funny because of the fact that The Crow is, I mean, I talked about my VHS history with the movie. On, it's funny, when I first got into DVD, obviously The Crow was a movie that I was interested in watching, but it wasn't really readily available. And part of that is because of the fact that it was released in the early days of DVD, but the transfer was apparently not very good. It didn't have much in the way of extras. So it's like, okay, I'll hold off. And in 2001, there was a two-disc collector's edition that came out, had a lot of extras on it, not as much because of studio politics. That's been well documented by one of the writers on the movie. And it also came in a 3-movie box set that included the 2 sequels at the time, Crow City of Angels and The Crow Salvation, which had not really come out theatrically. Mm-hmm. So I had never seen it, but I was still curious. And so I got the box set, and, you know, then we got another sequel a few years later, The Crow Wicked Prayer. And then a lot of what we've seen in the past 20 years since then has been filmmakers trying to do a new version of The Crow. And, you know, it's funny because of the fact that on the one hand, I'm very precious of this movie because of what it means to me personally. But as somebody who has read the James O'Barr graphic novel and sees how radically different the original film is to the graphic novel, I've always been relatively open to the idea of somebody else doing a readaptation that might get a little bit closer to the graphic novel. And it's funny, where this episode is going to be released less than a month before the actual fruits of that long production hell that this sort of soft reboot, I guess, or readaptation or whatever you want to call it, has had, because there have been so many names attached to it over the years. But we are getting one from Rupert Sanders, who directed Snow White and the Huntsman, as well as the live action Ghost in the Shell, and starring Bill Skarsgård as Eric Draven. And it's funny because of the fact that, I mean, I've seen some of what you've had to say about it. I mean, I think you and I are kind of in the same boat where it's like, okay, it's interesting. I think there might be some interesting things about it, but it just doesn't really, it kind of feels, it almost for me, I mean, obviously I won't know until I see it. It almost feels like they're kind of squandering the opportunity to do something unique with The Crow in this new version. What are some of your thoughts about the version that we're going to be coming up when you see the trailer?
So here's the thing. I mean, obviously I'm going to give it a chance because, again, like, not only is this the original all-time favorite movie, I was actually wholly on board with seeing another Crow movie, even though The Crow's kind of like Jaws to me. There's only one Crow movie that's, in my opinion, good. The rest got progressively worse. and we didn't even, I keep forgetting that there was a TV series starring Iron Mark Dacascos.
Yeah.
Which I love Mark, but like, I can't unsee his version of The Crow, especially when watching Iron Chef or even Cry Out to the Grave.
Right.
Which is a totally underrated classic. Mm. totally not a 2000s kid here or anything. But I think there's two things that stick out to me in a not so positive way with this new remake. A, the big elephant in the room, that SoundCloud Joker design.
Yeah.
Not a fan of that. Mm-hmm. I know it's supposed to be, you know, part of modern times because that's kind of like the new goth.
Yeah.
In a way. You know? But to me, he looks like a Chipotle bag.
Mm-hmm.
Or the desk that people write on in detention. That's what that crow looks like. I don't care for that.
Yeah.
I'm glad they're trying to make it different and more modern, obviously, to try to bring in a new audience. On the other hand, the other thing I don't like is the fact that it's the same crow as Eric Draven. Because, A, no one's going to be Brendan Lee.
No.
Nobody is.
Mm-hmm.
Love Momoa to death. I don't even think Momoa would be able to top that.
No,
I know Momoa would probably have done his own version, but he wouldn't have been able to top
it. He wouldn't have been in retrospect, I think he would have been interesting from a physicality standpoint, but at the same time, if you're looking at what Brandon Lee did to his body to get the look of Eric Draven from the graphic novel. Momoa is the exact opposite of that. And so it's that would have been I mean, I think I would have been curious because I think they had a fairly decent interesting director at the time that might have
Corin Hardy for from The Nun.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. But at the same time, it's like, yeah, Momoa is just not the fit for that. It's like, I don't know why. I mean, okay, he's got long hair. You could kind of see him get the look, but yeah, I just don't see it. No, I agree with you on, Skarsgård's look though. I'm not a fan of it either. I wasn't a fan of it when they did that for the Suicide Squad Joker, and I just don't think it's not an interesting look, and it's a shame because I think Skarsgård is probably the best choice they've ever had as far as somebody to play a new version of the Crow. But I just don't know how that look is gonna go.
No, and another thing is like Skarsgård is a great choice. I honestly was kind of gunning for Pattinson a little bit after watching The Batman.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there, I'm like, you know, obviously they probably didn't do this because, you know, social media is social media in a very, very not so great way.
Yeah.
Not only would I say make a new Crow, I'm probably gonna get a lot of crap saying this, but why not make the Crow a woman?
I know.
I think it'd be a very interesting direction, like, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's like we probably both know intellectually the reason why, because of just misogyny and the idea of, oh, well, no way you can accept a female Crow. It's the same argument for
on social media, yeah, and the fact that Hollywood likes to keep things safe because safety is kind of like the biggest like trend.
Yeah, as much as people complain for Hollywood being woke and, you know, all about diversity hires and stuff like that. Yeah, no, there's
really not.
They're safe as they can be. But I mean, and the thing is, it's like one of the things that was interesting when the Crow Save Angels was coming out, there were three comic runs of new Crow stories that came out that Obar had a hand in. And one was a Native American one that I thought was really interesting. I can't remember if one was a female Crow, but it feels like one was. I'd have to pull them out. But
I think there was at one point. I could be wrong, too.
And I know one of the original plans for City of Angels was, like, Sarah, because the character of Sarah from this movie is in City of Angels. She's one of the main characters, and she works with Ash in that movie. I think one of the original ideas was she was going to be the new Crow, which that would have been a weird choice. That would have been an interesting choice, and I think Mia Kirshner could have probably crushed it. But at the same time, I mean, there are so many issues with Crow Save Angels in general because, I mean, the producers got way too safe and decided, no, we got to make it closer to the original one in terms of how it wraps up and stuff like that. Because if you ever read the novelization of the Crow Save Angels, it really is a romantic tragedy, how it plays out. And it's really fascinating. And it's always pissed me off that we never got that version on screen because of the fact that even in the supposed director's cuts that have been released that don't really, they add some, but they don't change much to the trajectory of the story. It's still the same story that we saw in theaters, but it's really disappointing. And one of the things I liked about The Crow's Salvation is because, well, at least it's taking a different avenue to telling a Crow story. It's basically making The Crow kind of a police procedure, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, even that is flawed for several reasons. But at the same time, I mean, it's like, well, at least it's a different reason. But no, I love the idea of a female crow. And I mean, you know, I think part of the problem is that I think a lot of the reason it's taken so long to really get a new version of the Crow off the ground is because anybody you get in that role is going to be compared to Brandon Lee. That's just the fact of the matter. And
which is why I kind of like boggled my mind that they went with the same character.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Like, really?
Well, especially
you're literally asking for comparisons.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, and especially since there are things about it based on the trailer that make me think, well, maybe they're going in somewhat of a different direction that's closer to the graphic novel. But then there are also other things that are wildly different from the graphic novel that it's like, what are you doing? You can't necessarily have it both ways. And I don't know. We'll see what it is. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Brandon Lee cast the thing I will say about Brandon Lee, I mean, you know, I think I talked to Robert about this because we had this kind of discussion as well, because we brought Heath Ledger as well. You know, I mean, if Brandon Lee had lived and had the career that you feel like he could have had based on this movie, based on what he had done before, would this movie be as remembered as it is? And while there's a part of me that obviously thinks, well, maybe not, there's also a part of me that really does feel like this movie captured a moment in time that really is kind of unassailable. I mean, it really... And you look at the production design, you look at the fact that it really captured a goth perspective of things that goes beyond what like Tim Burton had done and like Batman and Beetlejuice and all of that, in a way that really reflected some of the alienation of Gen X in the mid-90s. And I think that's one of the things that does sustain. And a lot of that comes down to the soundtrack. And I've listened to the soundtrack several times recently, and I still love that soundtrack. It's something where it's like, I know exactly which tracks are coming up. I basically have it memorized, like which one's after which one, and there's not a single one of those tracks that I skip, because it's all good. There are certainly ones that I like more than others, but yeah. I just love, if I listen to that album, I've got to listen to the entire thing.
The Crow for Gen X is kind of like Black Panther in 2018 in a way. Both not only are very representative of the culture in time, where, you know, Black Panther's obviously more representative of Black culture.
Yeah.
And a lot of African ancestry thrown into not only the roots of a character and the setting of Wakanda, but also within some of the music as well. Whereas The Crow is more representative of goth culture. Mm-hmm. But both movies have soundtracks that tell the story of the movie, that basically are an auditory narrative sort. Mm-hmm. That's honestly why The Crow soundtrack and the Black Panther soundtrack as well stands out as top tier movie soundtracks.
Yeah.
Where a lot of movie soundtracks, even the ones I love to death, Scorpion King, Early 2000, Be the Damned, like I've mentioned before. Most of those soundtracks, Scream 3, which is another one I listen to a lot, they put together songs just to have names on them.
Yeah.
The Crow has the names. They got Nine Inch Nails. They got The Cure. They've got Stone Temple Pilots. But those songs actually go with the narrative of the film.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point in having them on there and having those songs on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just about commerce.
Yeah.
Which honestly is one of the things that made it so timeless. Another thing is how, while the plot is pretty much like A to B simple.
Yeah.
Which nowadays I'll take. there is no Kroll multiverse.
Thank
God. I mean, I probably would have eaten it up knowing myself, but no multiverse, thank God. But it's very dead set simple, but the world is also a character of itself.
Mm-hmm.
The world of Detroit basically is its own character, the setting.
Yeah.
Which is something that the Batman, I thought, accomplished very well with Gotham.
Mm-hmm.
Is it's Gotham itself as a character in the Matt Reeves Batman movie.
Yeah.
Any movie that has a simple plot with the world being a character is definitely like S tier in my book. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think to a certain extent, that's something that the sequels kind of forgot. And as much, and I will say, I love the soundtrack for Crow Save Angels. It's terrific. But, and I think they tried to make Los Angeles a character in the film, but there was something about the way they designed it that just didn't fit.
I think the way they designed, and this was my problem with City, my main problem with City of Angels, is they mistook being dark for being mean-spirited.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like when came off as very try-hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've seen movies like that before. It's like, oh, this is dark, it's rough, and it's like the most mean-spirited, gross, exploitative.
Yeah.
I actually remember watching City of Angels on TBS Superstation. Because, you know, I haven't dated myself enough yet. 8-year-old kid, by the way, watching this at like 10 o'clock at night. And the Thomas Jane scene came up, and I was so disturbed by this. I'm like, this movie is terrible.
Yeah.
Obviously, I know that, you know, thick people in the world exist, and I get it. But, like, the problem I had with that film was the same problem I had with AVP Requiem, with the Maturity War scene.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to go into that, but those who've seen it know what I'm talking about. Totally mean-spirited. And it felt like executives were playing it safe but trying way too hard to almost up the ante.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying too hard to stand out without realizing what truly made that stand out.
Yeah.
Having a great soundtrack is awesome. Having a soundtrack that's great, that flows to the narrative, is even better.
Mm-hmm.
Having a world designed to feel like a character is better than just having a world that just looks cool.
Yeah.
You know, having random villains be cartoonishly mean, sure, but when you have villains like Michael Wincott and his right-man man being the OG Candyman,
yeah,
himself, Tony Todd, that to me stands out.
Mm.
I mean, obviously, I'm not saying every movie should have them as villains. please don't encourage AI usage. Please, for the love of God. Yeah.
But oh, God.
I love the fact that, like, those two actors themselves playing real, they took villainous roles that if anyone else of lesser talent played them, they would just be one note and generic. But having someone like Michael Wincott or Tony Todd play villains that really aren't the most fleshed out.
No.
Kind of elevates them.
Yeah.
You know, and not only that, but their looks also stand out too.
Well, and also
I just love Tony Todd.
Well, and both those actors have two of the best voices in Hollywood history. I mean, they're easily recognizable as themselves when they play roles, and they just add in a level of authority to even the most vicious role that I think is interesting and always is compelling. And yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, one of the things, you know, The Crow as a narrative is fairly straightforward. It's basically Death Wish with a supernatural edge. And it's, but at the same time, what makes it stand out is the actors and what each actor brings to that role. Whether you're talking about Brian Lee, whether you're talking about Michael Wincott, whether you're talking about Tony Todd, whether you're talking about Ernie Hudson. Albrecht. And
that was another thing too, is like, it's the only film of the franchise where all the side characters I actually am invested in.
Yeah.
I'm not just like sitting there going, okay, when's The Crow coming back? When is Eric Draven coming back? I'm getting bored of these characters. No, I like spending time with Albrecht and Sarah in the beginning. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is kind of sweet. It's like having a cool little moment here. Two characters that are really, really good people. They're kind of like some of the only good people in this movie in terms of, you know, morality, sure, but it's, and you know, there's also like comedy with Ernie Hudson's character that didn't feel, you know, Disney-fied,
no,
so to speak.
Now, and one of the things that I know happened in the aftermath of Brian Lee's death was when one of the things that they did was they added moments with Albrecht and Sarah, really fleshed out their arc together, which really does help turn this into a something that is more accessible. And that's not, and I'm not saying that as a bad thing. It's never a bad thing to have a movie be accessible. But I think this movie, there's a way for this movie that could have been very nihilistic. And I think that by making some of the choices they did when they came back to finish it, especially with Albrecht and Sarah, I it's important because it adds a depth of humanity because of the fact that we see that Eric Draven is not the only person here who we see there are other people here who could be impacted by the violence of this city. And people who ultimately have good in them to maybe make this city better, even if Erica isn't able to do so quite as much as he can, because everybody has a role by the end. And I think that's always a really interesting way of doing this. And I love Ernie Hudson in this movie. I think Rochelle Davis, who played Sarah, is wonderful in this movie. It's a kid performance that I do think there are times where you could certainly, where it borders on kind of annoying kid, but at the same time, there's such a warmth when it comes to her and Eric that it just elevates the material so beautifully.
Yeah. They basically add humanity to the film. I mean, obviously Brendan Lee's performance does as well, but they add the type of humanity to the world that is pretty much devoid of it.
Yeah.
Is how I see it. And that's kind of the biggest mistake that a lot of the sequels have made. And I don't know how this new film's going to approach that.
Yeah.
I mean, I like Rupert Sanders as a visual director because he can make things look cool.
Yeah.
I didn't care for Snow White and the Huntsman, especially when you're dealing with a clash of overacting and underacting in that movie. That was, you know, no offense. I know she's gone through indie boot camp, but Kristen Stewart and Charlize Theron.
Yeah.
We can kind of pit two and two who was over and who was under there, but
right.
Like having that, but also having like really cool little visuals thrown in there. I actually liked Ghost in the Shell.
Mm-hmm.
Especially considering how visually stunning the movie was. So in terms of it looking cool, they picked a decent director.
Yeah.
I just hope that, I mean, I don't know who the writers are. I had to take a look at that and what their resume is like. I just know it's not the writers of Madame Web. So yeah. At least we'll have hopefully something kind of decently written. Either way, like, Rupert Sanders is similar to Zack Snyder in a way where great visuals in terms of direction.
Yeah.
We're going to have a whole army coming after us on Twitter for this. So glad they activated mine. Great visual direction needs a strong writer.
That's all right. You're in a safe space when it comes to Snyder. I'm very much the same way with you. We're kind of on the same page in that respect.
His version of a crow probably would have been actually kind of cool, I'm not gonna lie. But at the same time, it also would have probably been like City of Angels level of mean spirited. Actually, yeah. It would have made City of Angels look like Barney. But no, we would have had to wait like 8 months for a better version, supposedly, or you know, 7 years. I like a mini rant. I hate to get off on a tangent, but like mini rant here, like just make your movie good the first time.
Yeah.
Like, I know making movies is hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know people who film, who are out filming and doing great stuff. Whether it's independent or not, but this whole like constant teasing of, oh, we have a better version. It's like, I get it, it's studio politics, but why? Why are, like, it's becoming like The Boy Who Cried Wolf.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to The Crow, like, I don't know it, because all I see in this trailer, for example, I mean, the Ozzy Osbourne Post Malone song, I have on my Spotify playlist. Judge me as you will. I was like, all right, cool song choice. Obviously, Post Malone's going to be on the soundtrack. It's 2024. Not denying that. It feels like, and conceptually, it's kind of cool having, you know, a hybrid of, I think Jeremy John said this in his trailer review. It's like The Crow mixed with Scorpion from Mortal Kombat, which to me sounds phenomenal on paper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a Mortal Kombat fan myself. I know I was playing Tekken earlier, but I'm a Mortal Kombat fan myself. I'd be on board for that. But it feels like John... It feels way too much like John Wick.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, the action looks decently filmed. I haven't seen scenes where quick cuts are butchering everything to the point where I can barely make out what's going on.
Yeah.
You know? I haven't seen the crow take 60 cuts to hop a fence. But, you know, I will say that's kind of like... There isn't a lot of soul involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the one thing, my biggest pet peeve with this new remake, by the way, and this goes for a lot of movies, even ones I like, such as a certain vampire movie that came out recently. I felt like I kind of watched the whole movie in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
So...
I mean, the thing...
Ernie Hudson...
Yeah.
Yeah, so... Albrecht and Sarah, obviously, were kind of, like, the human aspects of that world. And... I don't feel like we're going to get that with this movie. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like we're going to get that with this remake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and getting back to the original, because you know, obviously, you know, we'll see what the Rupert Sanders film is. I mean, I'm kind of like you, and one of the things I do like about the Crow, the original Crows, I don't think you can fully pin down the movie in like 2 minutes. I you know, obviously you can get the revenge aspect, can set the supernatural aspect, but I don't think there's a way to really successfully, succinctly tie everything that makes the original film great in 2 minutes. I think that you can sell it on the soundtrack, you can sell it on the visuals, but I think you have to watch the movie to really appreciate what the filmmakers brought to the material, and especially what Brandon Lee brings to the material. Because, I mean, I think you look at there are moments in this movie that I absolutely adore, and I've talked about them elsewhere. I love the moment after he's escaped the shootout at Top Dollar's place, and he's walking on the sidewalk, and the kids are in their Halloween costumes and stuff like that, and he stops, he laughs, and you just get this moment with him. And Graham Revell's score is a huge part of this, and you know, we've talked so much about the song soundtrack. The score is completely complementary to the song soundtrack in the way it's not a traditional orchestral score, but isn't an overabundance of rock elements. It's a really wonderful blend of the two that is just beautiful. And there are some moments in this movie that I just will never forget. I mean, you know, the scene where Sarah is in the apartment and she's talking to Eric because she thinks he's going to be there, and she's kind of figured it out. And, you know, and you've got that moment at the end where the beautiful sunrise, it's one of the few times the sun truly comes out in this movie. It's just wonderful. And everything just, there's so many, as simple as this movie is, there are so many layers to the way the story is told. And no doubt some of that was added after Branley's death, but everything plays a fundamental part into why this movie works the way it does. And I love this movie so much. I think from the opening moments this movie absolutely had me, and it's because, and I continue to just get sucked into this movie every time I watch it. It happened when I was watching it for this record, and I just absolutely, I love this movie so much. It really is, and it's funny because I didn't have that goth phase in me, but there was something about this movie from a visual standpoint, from a musical standpoint, that just clicked. And then there's the emotional aspect, and that came through more as I watched it going forward. And I can't even tell you how many times I've seen this movie. I've seen it dozens upon dozens of times. It's probably one of the movies I've seen the most over the years. And I mean, you can certainly, you know, it just is something, or something about this movie that has always resonated with me. And it's just such a beautiful film. And I love, like, we didn't necessarily talk about all of the supporting actors. There's just a wonderful collection of supporting actors in this. David Patrick Kelly, Michael Massey, John Polito as Gideon, Bae Ling as Top Dollar's sister / lover, and she just exudes this danger that is just really unnerving. And there's so much about this movie that I could go on and on about. I mean, we've talked a lot about this movie. And I mean, we've obviously talked about the remake that's coming and other things, but I do want to bring it back to this one, because it's what was it about? I mean, you've kind of talked about it. What was it about this film where you had that kind of similar moment that I did, where it's like, this is one of my favorite movies of all time, if not my favorite movie of all time?
Well, honestly, like, it's a number of things. I mean, the timing of me finally discovering it versus, like, my internal journey of, like, finding myself and what I truly like and who I am. The Crow kind of, like, represents that part of me that, even though I'm not Gen X, even though I was not even born yet until the movie came out, I think. When did the movie come out again?
94.
About, like, 94. Yeah, I mean, oh yeah, I was, like, 5 months out. So I was still, like, a peanut when that movie came out. You know, but even with all that, it's like, I feel like this sort of resonates with me on a spiritual level because of the aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And it kind of represents, like, how a lot of kids in the 90s sort of watch this as a rebellious sort of edge. I mean, yeah. As some sort of, like, sign of rebellion. I was always a rebel kid growing up, so, like, this was kind of like my Black Panther in terms of being the rebel.
Yeah.
So it kind of represented the rebelliousness for me. And I think that's pretty much it. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I you know, there's a certain, I think there's a certain affinity. I think there's a certain affinity for outsiders or people that may not necessarily fit in to normal life. And, you know, like you were saying, you were kind of, you know, going on, you were sort of in the middle of a spiritual journey for yourself when you watched this. I mean, honestly, I mean, the pandemic, I mean, that brought a lot out of a lot of people. I certainly had those moments too. And I do think that this movie speaks to outsiders that in a way that is universal, and but at the same time it's specifically going to speak to people who don't necessarily fit into the mold of society and what society wants from people. And I think that is one of its biggest, I think that's one of its biggest strengths. I think it comes from, I mean, you look at the characters of Eric Draven, you look at Sarah, you look at Albrecht, they're all part of this. You know, I mean, even the moments we see of Shelley, you know, her and Eric are very, you know, they're not a normal couple. I mean, they were going to get married on Halloween, for crying out loud. And but yeah, I mean, this, I think this has this movie, more than any film from Gen X, I think has an appreciation for the outsider in a way that few movies, even from that time, really capture.
Yeah. No, definitely. All that is 100% true. And it just became, yeah, it's definitely the spirit of the film, characters, and the world. Yeah. Because of just how grim the world is, and seeing people basically being celebrated for being themselves. That's basically what it's, this unconventional couple is literally just being themselves, and they get murdered for for a pretty nefarious reason. And, you know, fate, like being a crow, basically decides to give them the opportunity to right that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, I actually have the graphic novel myself. My boss actually bought it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Totally a very well written and beautifully illustrated graphic novel.
Yeah.
For sure. Definitely love how different The Crow is one of those films, one of those stories where, like, in the era of time, you can sort of mold the aesthetic, but you can never change the spirit out.
Yeah.
So, like, the graphic novel was written in the mid-80s, so metal and mullets were very popular back then, and the art reflected that time, whereas in the 90s, it was about goth and grunge, so the visuals were reflective of that time.
Mm-hmm.
If we made a proper Crow movie in the mid-2000s, emo and skateboarding would have probably been more of like the kind of reflection to sort of head for. I didn't see Wicked Prayer. I just saw a picture of John Connor as a crow with Sharpie written on his face. And I was like, no.
You're missing nothing. You're missing nothing.
No. I've watched Cody Leach's review, and it's probably better than the entire movie.
Yeah.
To be quite honest. That and the fact that I was like, I already had to see Edward Furlong get wasted in Dark Fate. I really don't want to have to sit through that again.
Yeah.
With the Crow, like, it sucks. I feel bad for him, but it's like, no.
Yeah. No, I mean, you were missing nothing with Wicked Prayer. I it's one of the worst films I've ever seen. I just absolutely cannot stand that movie at all. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I would be remiss, obviously, if I did not mention the director, Alex Proyas, one of my favorite filmmakers. I've talked about him several times before. I also did Dark City, also did iRobot, Knowing, Gods of Egypt, which is not a good movie, but, you know, nobody's perfect.
With the writers of Madame Web.
Oh, we'll God, that's not. Right. Yeah. Wow, that explains so much. Explains so much about that. But, yeah, and then Darius Wolski is a cinematographer doing spectacular work. You know, and before my discussion with Robert on Close Watch, I listened to the Alex Proyas commentary, and I was interested to hear that they originally wanted to shoot in black and white as sort of a tip to the cap of the graphic novel, but they weren't allowed to do it. And what I love is they found a way to bleach out the color so much in the film that it has a sense of lack of color except for red. And I mean, there's certainly other color, but it's very minimal compared to red, which really stands out. And you know,
like Sin City.
Yeah. And it's, but at the same time, it's stylistic, but it also grounds the just how brutal this world is because of the fact that you don't get much in the way of color. And I'm very curious to see, because I know Wolski had a part to play in the 4K restoration that's coming out, and I'm fascinated to see what this looks like in 4K. I can't wait to see what this looks like in 4K, especially with him having a part in that.
You know what I want to see with this film? I mean, I think I've talked about it on Twitter before, you know, well, before I deactivated it. I want to see this movie get re-released in IMAX.
Oh, that would be
especially
something.
For the window scene alone. Like,
yeah.
A 4K restoration re-released in IMAX would be perfect for this movie.
Yeah. Because yeah, it would.
I mean, at this point, I'll take a Fathom event viewing,
right?
Just so I can see like, all this movie the first time in theaters. But like,
yeah,
The Crow and IMAX, I think, would be perfect.
That would be fantastic. And I'm disappointed that there really hasn't been much talk in the way of re-releasing this film. I mean, maybe it has something because I know one of the original producers, Edward R. Pressman, is one of the ones producing the new film, but at the same time, it's like, man, I want to see this in theaters again. And yeah, I mean, to your point, IMAX would be tremendous to see this. God, I would definitely make the trip for IMAX. I saw it again in the theaters 5 years ago. The one of the local art houses played it for 25th anniversary, and it was so great to see it in theaters again. I loved it. It was fantastic. It was my first time since that first time seeing it. So, there are so many re-releases coming out now that's like, yeah, I would love, and it seems like they're really embracing re-releases as a big part of the movie going landscape now, which is great. I think in beyond Fathom events, but yeah, I would love to see this get a re-release, especially in something like IMAX. That would be amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Because like a 4K or, you know, above restoration of any film, any classic film being re-released, Like, I actually went to, like, when Cinema Day happened, I actually went to go see Jaws for the first time in, like, XD 3D. And even though I've seen the movie dozens of times at home, with friends, with family, alone, seeing it in that dark room with the crowd that I went to go see it in,
yeah,
there is something about that that just felt like I was watching it for the first time again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the corpse in the water jump scare, for example, literally got my theater still. And just the fact that, like, everyone was just into it.
Right.
It's like, wow, this movie is over 50 years old, almost 60 years old, and it still feels magical. So, like, having something like that for The Crow, I think, would be fantastic, especially with this new movie coming out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't really have a whole lot more to say on my end. Chris, did you have anything more you wanted to say before we wrap this up?
I actually do have a question. This would be a very interesting little discussion piece. If you were to pick someone to play a brand new character for The Crow that wasn't Skarsgård, I mean, we love Skarsgård, but, like, who would your pick be?
Man, that's... Because, I mean, the question, of course, is what direction do you want to take the character? Because we never have had a... To your point, we've never had a female crow. And the thing is, it's like, who do I think would... And I love that idea. I would love to see it. I think it's... I mean, that is one thing where it's like, I almost do hope that this new movie is good enough to where maybe we do get more movies and they actually do a female crow. But... Trying to think
the late August release day is kind of discouraging, though.
Huh?
I know they moved it to August 23rd because,
yeah,
Bad Boys was gonna destroy at the box office.
Yeah.
But yeah, Will Smith was gonna slap the crow at, yeah, the box office. Like,
female crow. Because I'm trying to think of who a good choice would be for that. And I'm not sure. Like, I know I would want to have a female crow, but I can't think of anybody off the top of my head who just stands out as, like, yes, absolutely, that would be the choice. So, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So, but I do think there would be a lot of room for potential with a new crow, without the baggage of Eric Draven and that character. I would be fascinated to see a Native American crow. I would be in live action. I know they one time. You know, one of the last times that they tried to get one off the ground in the mid-2000s was, like, I think they were talking about DMX for a black crow. And I think that would have some potential. But, I mean, not necessarily with DMX, but, I mean, you know, again, you get the right actor, it would be fantastic.
I don't know how DMX would work. I mean...
Well, I don't necessarily know right now, but, you know, he was a possibility in the 2000s. I mean, that was when, you know, you were starting to see a lot of hip hop artists and rap artists getting into acting at that time. So, I mean, that was part of the reason.
Cradle to the Grave came out and made money.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Really. Love that movie. But honestly, my picks, I mean, Amber Midthunder would be a good one, I think, especially for the Native American storyline as well. Melissa Barrera, Sasha Calle from The Flash, and what's the other one I had in mind? Jenna Ortega, maybe? I mean, that would be typecasting, to be fair.
Yeah.
But, like, those I think would be pretty good options. I mean, I think my wild card would be Hayley Steinfeld, but I'm very biased on that pick.
Mm.
But having, yeah, especially, like, a woman of color, like Melissa Barrera or Amberman Thunder, I think would be perfect choices for a new crow in terms of that direction.
Yeah.
So those would be my picks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and I mean, I could see both of those very much so. Yeah. Well, Chris, thank you very much for joining me on this episode. It's great to get to talk to you. This was the first time we really have talked at length. It was great to talk to you about and to share your feelings on this movie that I know that you love so much. And I'm glad that I had somebody here who shared a lot of my same feelings about this film as we talk about it in honor of its 30th anniversary, because of the fact that, I mean, I knew if I did want to talk about The Crow again, it had to be something with somebody who had the same kind of connection to it that I did. I'm glad that we were able to have this discussion.
Yes, I'm glad we are as well. Thanks for having me. Forward to doing more episodes in the future.
Maybe. Yeah, definitely. I'd like to thank Chris for joining me on the podcast. It was great to have him on as a first-time guest and share his thoughts on The Crow. Like I said, the episode was great to share this discussion with somebody whose feelings rival mine on this movie. I think if I had to talk about it for the 30th anniversary, this was the way to go. That's going to be it for this episode of the Sonic Cinema Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to have more Class of 1999. We're going to try to get some established classics in here, as well as some more episodes, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you very much. Anybody who clicks subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, thank you very much to anybody who subscribes to patreon.com/SonicCinema. And of course, anybody who follows my written work and work in general at www.sonic-cinema.com. Thank you very much.